If COVID-19 lasts a few more months, it'll have a positive aspect for once. At the end of October, we'll have one less task. We may have to buy a costume, but already have a mask. Welcome to Spectrum West, where the arts and culture of West Wisconsin shines and shouts. I'm Al Ross. This week, it's called the Universal Music Center, and you'll find it in Red Wing, Minnesota. The founder and director is Mike Arturi, with quite a musical resume to his credit. And this nonprofit educational and hands-on music center reflects his love for the craft and its performance. He joins us, as most everyone does nowadays, by phone. Catherine Thomas and Wayne Merrick discuss the upcoming unique outdoor performances in Chippewa Falls of Newsies by the Eau Claire Children's Theater. The director of the Wisconsin Historical Society is Christian Overland, and they have their hands full juggling locations and coordinating the archiving of over 1,800 people's experiences during the pandemic of 2020. He's here to explain. And here's where this week's voyage shoves off. It's a clever name for a garden on a college campus in Menominee, UW Sprout. It has supplied produce for a few years now at UW Stout, but not this year, because the people have all gone home to avoid passing along a virus you may have heard of. But it doesn't mean the Sprout spirit doesn't live on in this growing season. It does. And you'll discover in this first conversation with Sarah Rickle, sustainability manager at the university, whose job is a big and important one. A news piece from the Stout Communications Department caught my eye. As you know, it was about a garden with a clever name, UW Sprout Campus Garden, and the fact that it could not function normally this year because of, as many things, COVID-19. Before, Sarah, we talk more about sustainability. Tell us a little bit about the garden that isn't this year.
It's a 1/5 acre garden that we've had since 2014, and we've had a number of students wanting to grow food on campus, so we decided to create a garden, an old city lot that we had available to us. We took down the house and put up a garden, and we grow a variety of sustainably grown vegetables, fruits, and herbs. We have a CSA, it's a community-supported agriculture program, where students, faculty, and staff can purchase shares in the garden each season. Okay. And then the garden staff deliver the fresh produce each week to those customers. Cool. And all deliveries are done by bike.
Wow, that's sustainability right there.
It is, yes.
So you had plants ready for this year and they couldn't be utilized and they went somewhere. You donated them.
Yeah, we start plants as early as February each year, and we weren't obviously in February anticipating that COVID-19 would cause a hiatus for the garden. So we started nearly 200 plants and we needed to find a home for them. My student staff and I talked for quite a while and decided a good home would be a place where food security could be leveraged. And so we found a couple gardens in the community, one in Menominee, the Dunn County Jail Garden, which is a restorative justice program for inmates to grow food. They grow all their food for the Stepping Stones Food Pantry in Menominee. And then the Forest Street Community Garden in Eau Claire, which donate some of their food to the community table in Eau Claire. So we felt that that was a great way to make use of the plants and make sure that the food was getting into the hands of people who needed it.
Let's talk about you a little bit. You have your master's in sustainability community development from UWRF. The environment, has that been a concern of yours from a young age? When did Sarah Rickle decide that this is what she was going to do?
I grew up with parents who were very interested in being outside, and my mom in particular was an avid gardener. And so that was kind of my inroad into sustainability was local food systems. That's what I focused on a lot in grad school. And then it kind of went into lots of different areas of sustainability is really in everything that we do. So now I do, obviously, with UW Sprout, work on local food, but I also do projects in buildings and energy and waste and transportation, landscaping, curriculum. It really runs the gamut. My position was hired full-time in 2009, so I've been working at Sprout for nearly 11 years. And in that time, we've amped up our sustainability commitments and practices and become a much more sustainable campus thanks to the work of a lot lot of people on campus.
Sarah Rickel on the phone with us. She is sustainability manager at UW Stout. Their slogan is Sustainable Stout. There is an impressive list of future strategies that I saw in the information that you were kind enough to send, which included, I believe, a PowerPoint presentation. What's the process of planning strategies? Because, as I said, there were a lot of them. Do you include only very doable things, or do you put together a really huge wish list and then you know that you can check off a good number of them?
It's the latter. We create a vision for what we'd like to see for a sustainable campus and for our campus in particular. Being a state school, there are some limitations just because we, up until recently, had our energy bills paid for by the state. And so, you know, incentivizing us to reduce cost with reduced energy has been hard, but that's changing. And so we really are trying very hard to each year, take a chunk out of those plans that we've developed over the past 10 years. So we have a campus sustainability action plan, which is a 30-some page document. And each year we update that. And that's done by our sustainability steering committee, which I chair on mm-hmm. campus. And that's a group of 15 to 20 students and faculty and then staff who sit down and really go through, you know, strategically planning how we will be a sustainable campus. And then we work with our chancellor and our vice chancellor and our strategic planning group for the entire campus to come up with initiatives each year that we take a bite out of that plan. We have a number of committees on campus. We have a campus-wide energy committee. We have a waste reduction work group, and we have the sustainability steering committee. All of us are working on different initiatives to make sure that we're working toward becoming a more sustainable campus and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm. There's also a Student Association Sustainability Council. How are young people in the fight? Does what's touted as the me generation have room for an us generation? Are they doing well?
Mm-hmm. They are. It's been really interesting being at Stout for the last 11 years. We've always had students very interested in sustainability, but over my time here, I've just seen it more and more. You know, our green feed developed as a result of students being interested in wanting to kind of put their money where their mouth was. And so they created a student referendum and voted on it and created this fee where they pay 38 cents per credit, and that money is pooled and then put into a sustainability project that benefits students. Mm. For example, in the past 2 years, they funded $150,000 of solar panels on our Merle Price Commons building. Mm. They do a number of different things each year. A lot of them are energy related because that is our biggest greenhouse gas contributor, is our energy use. And so they are constantly working at putting funds into projects that make the campus more sustainable.
We're focusing, of course, on UW Stout, but I'm guessing that probably sustainability is big throughout the UW system?
Yes, definitely. There are sustainability offices at many of the UW schools. There are some without, but mostly there are sustainability offices or a person in a position like mine. A lot of schools have green feeds like we have, so it's definitely a movement across the system to try to be more sustainable at the campus level and in the system in general.
Well, you do very important work, and I know that you're not accustomed to talking on the radio, but just as you're able to stare environmental fears in the face and say, oh no, not on my watch, you were brave enough to engage in conversation, and I thank you for that. Sarah Rickel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Al. I appreciate it.
We are so fortunate to have great four-year and two-year campuses in Western Wisconsin. Higher education of the highest quality, right where we live. He's quite a well-known drummer and also leads a musical educational center, and Catherine Thomas previews Newsies coming next week to a fairgrounds near you, down the road on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the fully redesigned RAV4 with all-wheel drive and new safety features. Marquardt Toyota, located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. You know, we don't think about history until, one, we need it for perspective, or two, we're clearly living in historic times. Number two certainly applies as we speak, so we are thinking about history. And in Wisconsin, when we think about history, the Wisconsin Historical Society is a first thought. It's the keeper of our collective history. Right now, it's affected by the same thing we're all affected by, and it's working to record how we're being affected so generations of the future can feel for our viral and confusing times. Christian Overland is the Ruth and Hartley Barker Director and CEO of the State Historical Society. We spoke recently. Tell us about the Ruth and Hartley Barker designation on the directorship title.
So Ruth and Hartley Barker were great friends of the Wisconsin Historical Society, actually members of the Mead Paper Family Company. They was given to the society over the years, and they gave us a very nice leadership gift in one of our previous campaigns. And so in recognition of their support of the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Board of Curators endowed the position of the directorship. So I'm known as the Ruth and Hartley Barker Director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Does that fit on a business card?
It does. So, yeah, it's great recognition for the family.
Sure.
They've did so well supporting us over the years.
Well, tell us, because I'm curious, what's your history with history?
Oh, so my history with history goes back a long ways. I grew up in Minnesota.
Okay. You need to assure our listeners, though, that you're now a Badgers and Packers fan.
I am.
Okay.
And my daughter is going to UW-Madison this fall, too.
Good deal.
Studied history and art history and American studies at the University of Minnesota. Went on to work at the Minnesota Historical Society, and then went to graduate school out east. Started working at the Baseball Hall of Fame and historic Deerfield. Then moved my way back from Cooperstown to 26 years in the Detroit area to a place called the Henry Ford, which has museums of Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village, the Ford Rouge Factory Tour, as well as an amazing archive of American history and innovation, too.
The Wisconsin Historical Society is impressive. There are divisions, library, archives and museum collections, museums and historic sites, historic preservation office, programs and outreach office. There's also a Wisconsin Historical Foundation and friends of the Wisconsin Historical Society. So you guys are multifaceted.
Yes, we're one of the largest and oldest continuous operating historical societies in the United States. And so there's so many things, including, like you said, the State Historic Preservation Office, from publications to programs to museums, 12 museums across the state.
Mm-hmm.
We are Wisconsin's agency for history.
The concept of historical sometimes conjures up an image of musty and dusty and stuffy and fragile. But your society, which, as you said, is old, dates back to the 1840s, is fresh and always evolving. Our historical perspective is a living, breathing, changing thing simply because the times we commemorate were evolving in their own way. In fact, past evolution resulted in our present, as we all know. We are so much into the moment, Christian, and our tomorrows nowadays. Does it ever concern you that we don't look back often enough?
That's a really great question, Al. What we are concerned with is the Wisconsin Historical Society connecting the past to the present and hopefully, doing that, inspiring people to build a better future. And so that's our mission, quite frankly, is connecting people to the past by collecting, preserving, and sharing those stories. And we believe that the unparalleled access to history and the benefit of the knowledge of history has profound societal and cultural and economic benefits.
Sure.
So with that, we look at it from the standpoint of what do we do to keep connecting people to history? So we actually published the fourth grade history textbook for Wisconsin, which we're proud to say more than 68% of our teachers use throughout the state, which is the highest number of any state in the union, state agency publication being used by schools. So we're very proud of that. Our publication group publishes 20 books a year. We're looking at topics always that are relevant and compelling. But again, bridging towards the past and bringing that history forward and making it relevant. So it answers some important questions that people have for today, too.
Sure.
And that's really what we've always been about, going back to our very beginning of not just being an antiquarian society, but how do you actually make this history useful? So the idea of setting up the society and the territory before it became a state was to inform the new citizenry that was flourishing and burgeoning, to think about what was going on in United States history, creating it as we went along, too, not just looking in the past, but doing things and projects that actually establish historical moments in time, too.
You know, interesting that you bring up finding answers in history. I have written here, most every issue we deal with today has roots somewhere, and finding those roots can help us with today's harvest. Obviously, going on today, Black Lives Matter, climate change, pandemics.
Of course, yes. One of the things we looked at in our collections of the 1819 pandemic, for instance, is Wisconsin was the only state in the Union that was so prepared, uniquely prepared, by having a public health board at the state level and then county and municipality level boards. They could quickly isolate people and get the schools closed and save thousands of lives. The only state in the Union was that organized with the Public Health Commission.
Wow.
So isolation can transfer into social distancing, you know, of today. And using those stories, we actually worked with artists in the past 13 weeks to create public art and a poster project, artists in Wisconsin that we commissioned, just about the COVID-19 project, but using the idea of what past posters were, call to action posters, whether they're from the World War I or from the WPA projects during the Depression or from World War II, to capture those graphic presentations and making them relevant for today with today's message. So even today, thinking about what we're collecting for COVID-19, the era that we're living in, we hope that that's going to be a useful collection for people to deal with pandemics in the future.
Enjoying a phone call with Christian Overland. He is the Ruth and Hartley Barker designated director and CEO, Wisconsin Historical Society. How long, Christian, does it take for something to be historical, do you think? So much that fascinates us is the old stuff, the black and white photos, the Model Ts, the old wars. But, of course, as we all know, history is also being written right now. When will that feel historic, do you think? Is there a marinating period?
Well, it's an amazing process. Let's say right now our nation, the American conscience of what do they deem to be historic in nature and what do they deem to be kind of present. Usually historians would look at it like 25 years in the past. But in the most recent decades, that idea has been changing. Our curators, for instance, are collecting objects right now, as well as our archivists about COVID-19, and also some of the Black Lives Matter issues that have been coming up in presentations and what's been going on. You know, it all depends on what is in the future, right? When people look back and kind of the relevancy of stories. But that's what our job is as the Historical Society, to make sure that those collections are preserved, make sure that they're accessible, and make sure that we're able to share them with people, too, so they're relevant.
The Wisconsin Historical Society is a physical plant as well as a concept and an entity, a plant where we can come and we can spend some time looking at our past. How deeply can one dive in to whatever they want to dive into in an online experience?
In an online experience, our residents of Wisconsin and people across the United States, across the world, can dive into our collections digitally and get connected into genealogy. We have the second best genealogical collections in North America. In terms of like North American history, only the Library of Congress beats our collection out. And that's unusual for a state history organization because they usually just focus on the geographical and political boundaries of that state. But early on, before we became a state, we were collecting nationally, and we never stopped. So to answer your question, Al, you could actually connect with genealogy, and if you're looking at your family going back into colonial times, we can connect with papers that people have from colonial times. We have all sorts of genealogical records, but we also have journals. One of the things that we were talking about recently is the Civil War journals we collected, because we actually, in the 1860s, sent out with the soldiers coming from Wisconsin going to war pencils and journal tablets to write in. So we have one of the most important Civil War archives of soldiers in the United States as well. So there's lots to connect to. Even in modern times, we have one of the larger civil rights collections in the United States. So even if you were living in the South, we have collections from the South that were going on back then, too.
There's at least a couple books by Wisconsin people who found letters and things. That's just fascinating stuff.
Oh, it is. And the Civil War is still a fascinating era. I think when the 20th century closed, the Civil War became kind of the era of the 19th century that became prevalent in everybody's mind in America.
Mm-hmm.
It still holds there. Things that dropped off when the 20th century closed and people were looking back, you know, were things like the 1830s, which were important times in America,
sure,
and the Federalism period. But the Civil War still remains a very relevant topic for people today.
As we've alluded several times during our conversation already, we are in historic times. They're affecting how we live and how we operate. Tell us some of those effects. I know that some of your sites are open and some are not.
That's correct. So 9 of our sites are open right now. We got them open up a few weeks ago. What we're doing right now with those sites, from Circus World to Old World Wisconsin, Black Point down in Lake Geneva, up in North Madeline Island Museum, as well as we're opening up Wade House, which is in Sheboygan, beginning of August, and, of course, the southwest sites of Stonefield and Cassville and Villa Louie and Prairie du Chien, and in Mineral Point, we have Pendarvis and Circus World Museum, like I said, and also H.H. Bennett up in the Dells. 9 of those sites are open, and we're doing them by tours, where there are safe experiences for people. They're back-of-the-house type of tours, or the upstairs-downstairs tours, as well as the landscapes. And people really like it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get out of their house, and they want to experience something, and we're there for them. And people can look at wisconsinhistory.org and sign up and register for those tours, and we'll give them a great experience.
As usual. You brought up the poster project, and there is also a journal project that document these classic times. Rank and file people, can they journal?
Absolutely, and that's what's really important. Going back to what I was talking about with the Civil War journals in the 1860s, when Lyman Draper sent out with the soldiers journals and pencils, we did the same thing, kind of the concept with COVID-19, where we've been asking people across the state to create journals. So far, we have 1,840 people who have registered to participate in that project.
Wow.
They're everyday type of journals, from people writing, you know, notes in a little book, to video blogs, to photographic essays, to people doing digital stuff on their computer, and we're accepting all of them. And what's great about this is that it's coming from all parts of Wisconsin, from all walks of life, too, by the way, which is fantastic. Even school-age kids before the school shut down for the season, their teachers were working with them on them. And the project has not stopped. But if your listeners want to start a journal, please go to wisconsinhistory.org and sign up for it. It's a great opportunity to be a part of a collection. And the reason why we're doing this is we want to give people a voice to the future, because they're starting to figure out how to deal with pandemics.
Yeah.
And we hope that we can help solve future pandemics by what we've learned.
It's fun to imagine. Hopefully we're all here 100 years from now, people reading those journals.
Wow, that sounds like that was a tough time right there.
Because we say the same about 100 years ago and the other pandemics. In fact, everything else that went before us, we just think it was so tough. And I'm guessing that our times now will seem tough to them way off in the future. One of the best quotes I've read lately in preparing for our conversation, quotes about history, the one I liked the most said, "Maybe history wouldn't repeat itself if we listened once in a while."
Yeah, good one.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Christian Overland, Director and CEO, Wisconsin Historical Society, thanks for taking time with us. We're going to keep in touch because your organization is extremely important, and we're so proud of you.
Well, thank you, Al, and thank you for everything that you do for the arts and culture of Wisconsin, too. Your show is terrific.
Thank you so much. Again, the website is wisconsinhistory.org. If you've been looking for a good place to learn music, or yourself, or a young person you know, you'll want to catch this week's final conversation. But first, entertainers are said to live by the adage, the show must go on. And it's obvious that during a pandemic, it's a bit irresponsible to take that verbatim safely. The Eau Claire Children's Theater show is going on. And Catherine Thomas gets the scoop from Eau Claire Children's Theater director Wayne Merrick.
The show is Disney's Newsies, the Broadway musical. What is Newsies about?
The musical is the stage version of the 1992 very popular Disney movie, which kind of is a historical musical chronicling the New York Newsies labor strike of the late 1800s, newsboys that were almost living like orphans, were the newsies that delivered the newspapers to people, sold them on the streets. And when they raised the prices on them, they kind of formed a kind of a makeshift union and went on strike. So there is some historical accuracy to the show, but it's really a Broadway Disney musical. The history stuff is a brief lesson. It's really about the singing and dancing.
It is good timing for the musical, though, because July 20th marks the 121st anniversary of that strike back in 1899, and the show starts on the 22nd.
You got it. Good timing.
Now, you're talking about singing and dancing. Of course, that's what I think about first with musicals. But what surprises me about Newsies, not a surprise for people who really like musicals, is how serious and adult many of the themes are. But somehow having everything set to song and dance tempts me not to take it seriously, but it really is. What are some of the themes in Newsies that stand out to you?
You kind of hit it, though. This isn't something where people are going to come and go, my goodness, those poor children. It's just not the purpose of the show. Like you said, it's about the song and the dance. So what you're really going to be left with is, wow, what a talented group of young people. You're not really sitting there at a summer musical thinking about terrible conditions that these kids lived in, many of whom probably were orphans. They were living on the streets, in tenements, wherever they could find for very poor wages. You're not sitting there thinking about those things. You know, that's maybe the beauty of musical theater. It takes you away for a while. Yes, maybe the themes were based in history or unfortunate for the time or whatever, but that's not the point of the musical. There are other musicals, let's talk about Les Mis or something like that, where it is darker and the themes are much more at the forefront. This one's really about a bunch of teenagers and what they did and what they accomplished and wasn't that great of them, and look at those great dance numbers.
Uh-huh. And the cast is so largely made up of youth, so it's perfect for the children's theater, but the story itself is about a youth-powered movement. Is your cast kind of picking up on that? What do they make of that?
I guess, once again, I'll bring it back to the song and the dance, because that's really what we have to focus on. In our limited time of rehearsal, it's the choreography and nailing those dance numbers and learning their lines, getting the songs down. I don't know that anybody is doing the show because they felt very strongly about any themes or messages in the show. They're mostly doing it because they love the movie. That's why they're here. They love being in shows. It's all about the theater.
So tell me about the size of the cast for this production. I think you had auditions back in May.
Yep.
How many people turned out for that?
A total of 74 auditioned, both in person and virtually, and there are 41 in the cast.
Is that a usual size for a summer production?
The number of auditionees is very typical, and we kept the cast on the small side to allow for social distancing on stage.
Virtual auditions, I might be worried about it if I was doing a virtual audition versus one in person.
I mean, there are many companies that's all you do is you send in your tape. Not an unusual way to audition at all, by sending in your video clip of you singing. Most universities audition that way, right? When you're doing your audition tapes to get into the School of Music or theater or whatever, you send your audition tape in. Not uncommon at all to not be in person when you're auditioning.
Wayne Merrick is the executive director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater. He is here to tell us about their upcoming production of Disney's Newsies, the Broadway musical. The performances of that show are next week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's July 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. This year at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in Chippewa Falls. Gates open at 6. Show starts at 7:30. All right, so you've talked about how the show is really about the music and the dancing. What are some of your favorite songs in this production?
Oh, I would imagine the one that is probably one of the more fun songs, plus one that's most popular, is Seize the Day, which is very uplifting, empowering, where they do decide to strike, take their message to the streets. That's probably one of the most energetic numbers and probably one of the harder dance numbers. King of New York is also very high energy and a number of tappers in that number, so audiences always enjoy it when there's a tap number in a show, because it doesn't happen all that often in musicals that there's a big tap number. So it's always kind of fun to see that.
There are some slower songs, too. I think there's a love story thread in this musical.
There is. Can't have a musical without some kind of a boy meets girl or some kind of a love story going on in the background. So, of course, the leader of the union of the striking newsies, of course, starts falling for the daughter of the newspaper publisher. You got to have a little romantic tension worked into a show.
Of course. Well, you are producing this show in the midst of a global pandemic. And a lot of live performances have been canceled or postponed or rescheduled. How did you decide that it was okay to go ahead and stage this production now?
Because we're following the guidelines that we've been given by the county, and I guess all those guidelines that most people are very familiar with. For example, with the cast and the staff as they come to rehearsals, they're all using the same door that's propped open for them. They come in, they either wash their hands at the hand wash station or hand sanitize, check their temperatures. Everybody throughout the entire rehearsal process and during performances are wearing masks. The stage is marked off with X's 6 feet apart to allow them to stay in their dance formations, to be distanced on stage as well. Those kinds of things will transfer over into the audience. When they are seated, for example, we will make sure that seating is 6 feet apart or a 12-foot circle for family groups. To be able to space the crowd out at the fairgrounds, which there's plenty of room up there. They have all sorts of hand sanitizer stations, one-way traffic in the bathrooms, contactless paper towels and hand soap, things like that. Like I said, the performers will be wearing masks. The volunteers that are ushering and doing things like that that are in contact with the audience will be in masks. So it's all of the guidelines or recommendations from the health departments.
It's hard for me to imagine a musical where all the performers are wearing masks. The facial expressions and the projection of the voice.
Yep. We're using masks that were actually custom-made here. This will be the third show that we've used, let's call them communicator masks, the type of masks that somebody might use if they were hearing impaired or a lip reader. They're kind of like a cloth mask, only they are clear. The audience actually can see their faces. They can see their expressions. They can see their mouths. Because you're right, if you can't see their faces, it makes it a little disconcerting, or the cloth mask would muffle their voices. But the clear mask allow them to have their face be seen, and then their mics are placed on their forehead through their hair, which is what we would do if somebody had facial hair that gets in the way. So the mic is outside of the mask. The mask doesn't affect the sound then.
You found a lot of workarounds. When encountering all these things you have to do differently, did you ever think, you know what, this is just too much work. We're not going to do the show.
It's our business. Just like any other business trying to stay afloat, you know, this is our product. I guess just like a retailer or a restaurant or any other business that has to find the solutions to make sure that their business can stay afloat through this pandemic. I guess it's pretty much the same as any other business, finding their way through and making accommodations for what you need to do to present your product safely, put it that way.
What kind of turnout would you like? I mean, besides a good one, what does that mean or what are you expecting?
Sure. Our summer musicals tend to be high-energy dance musicals with big titles, and some, of course, are bigger than others. 300-400 people for a summer musical is looking pretty good because of summer vacations and things like that. You know, you get a big show like Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, easily can go above that. But given the recommendations of the health department in Chippewa, a nice-sized crowd of 200 to 300 people would be successful for us, plus only about 50% capacity of the fairground seating. That seems to meet both our needs to keep the capacity reasonable and to make it financially viable for us to produce.
Let's talk about more general things. How has the season been going so far? Say we're going to compare it to last year or a typical season. How's it been?
I guess prior to March, we were definitely, based on the finances, heading towards one of our most successful seasons, which only, you know, begets better shows and programming, you know, as the money gets reinvested. And that obviously quickly came to a halt. I think we counted the cancellation of 27 total performances of about 6 or 7 shows, meaning school matinees and public performances or shows that were outright canceled and rescheduled into 2021. So that all just kind of came to a standstill that good season of financial success and shows.
And what's happening for the rest of the 2020 season and also in 2021?
So as far as the rest of 2020, we've got Newsies coming up, and then Disney's 101 Dalmatians for a couple performances in August. And that's actually a show that was moved from April of this year to August. So that'll close out the 2020 season. The 2021 season has not been announced yet because we're still finalizing a few titles and some dates. And that season brochure usually comes out by the end of July, mid-August. So that's when I would assume that we start talking about what's going to happen this fall and into next spring and summer.
The Eau Claire Children's Theater's production of Disney's Newsies, the Broadway musical, happens next week, Wednesday through Friday. That's July 22nd, 23rd, and 24th at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in Chippewa Falls. Gates open at 6 p.m. each night, and the show starts at 7:30. Bring your own chairs, though. That's important.
Yes, it is.
More information at ecct.org, including tickets and the safety guidelines that we talked about today. You can also call 715-839-8877. We've been talking today with Wayne Merrick. He's the theater's executive director. Wayne, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine, as usual. Spectrum West on WPR. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, a locally owned community bank now offering checking account options. Charter Bank is dedicated to being invested in the community, customers, and employees. More information is at charterbank.bank.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mode long.
Well, music is said to be the universal language, so when teaching people how to use and enjoy it, it makes sense to do it under a name like Universal Music Center. The sensible guy, who also has a streak of rowdy in him somewhere, who made the concept a reality in Red Wing, Minnesota, is Mike Arturi. So why are we playing that song in the background? Well, I think the following conversation will clear up that and more.
I find a face for being a sleepy bulldog.
Because what you're doing is all about where you're going and we're going, that's the important thing to talk about. But where you've been is also interesting as well. So before we get on to that important stuff, where you've been, Mike, and some of what you still do, here are some hints for our audience. You didn't have to be so nice. Did you ever have to make up your mind? Do you believe in magic? Rain on the Roof, Daydream, Summer in the City. Six solid hints right there. And if you remove the N from the word hints, you get what these and a few others were. So, Mike, what do these hints tell our audience about you?
Well, thank you so much. Those are great hints. I hope everybody got them. I'm very happy to be here, and I thank you all for allowing me to be here today. And those are hit songs that were made popular by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee band, The Lovin' Spoonful. And The Spoonful's heyday was in the mid-60s. I have been drumming with them since 1996, coming up on 25 years now. And it's been great.
Wow. I danced to those hits in the 60s. I think I still could.
All right.
There's still a couple of original members left, right? So tell me about some of the gigs you have.
We have Joe Butler, who was the original drummer and who is a phenomenal singer. So he's up front handling the lead vocals, and Steve Boone, the other founding member, is on bass. Both of those guys played on all those records. You know, we play all over the country and parts of the world, and we do mainly theaters, showrooms, and casinos, and those are mostly the types of venues that we play. We were doing cruise ships. We're not doing them right now, obviously.
Yeah. Why does Sebastian's name, why is that always associated with, you know, the guy? As soon as you hear Love and Spoonful, you think John Sebastian. Did he write most of the stuff, or why was he was out front, of course.
Well, that's a really interesting question. John did certainly write all of the hits, but the group was a very unique, kind of an eclectic blend, you know, that had never been done before. Joe and Steve, the two guys that I work with now, had a top 40 dance band, you know, of the day out on Long Island. They were packing places. They knew all the tempos and they knew all the grooves, you know, and they knew all the stuff from popular music, where John was a pure folk artist. His passion was folk music. Then Zalianowski, who was the guitar player, was a phenomenally versatile guitar player, a highly unrecognized. I mean, his fans include George Harrison, Eric Clapton. I mean, the list goes on and on of people that used to study him. So it was a great blend of a lot of different capabilities. So John, on some occasions, had a fully formed song in mind, but on many, he came in, you know, with a set of chord changes and a set of lyrics, and together, all four of them crafted those songs. But John definitely was the writer, and he sang lead on all the hits. But, you know, it's such a deep catalog of material from them. They deliberately, with all that diversity in the lineup, tried to sound like a different band with every release.
Yeah.
You know, they sounded like country, you know, for Nashville Cats, heavy rock band from Summer in the City, you know, mm-hmm. a pop band for Do You Believe in Magic, and on and on and on.
It's interesting that they all got together in the first place. Sebastian was kind of a jug bandy kind of guy, and these guys were rock and rollers, but it sure did turn out to be magic, as they say, and we ended up believing. So we have already now established that Mike Arturi has the two C's, cool and credentials. Although I saw on your website one of your students playing, and behind her was a computer screen that said, anyone can be cool, but awesome takes practice. So don't let cool go to your head, Mike. Let's get on to the nuts and bolts. Universal Music Center is nonprofit. Tell us about that status.
When I put this together, my original plan was to have a blend of a legitimate formal music education where you're learning real music notation and you're learning music theory as opposed to just kind of chords and tablatures and that kind of thing. I wanted to have a legitimate music education coupled with a live performance experience. So that was the original business plan. I moved here to Red Wing in 2010. I was working on putting this together in Chicago, where I'm from. I got here and found some of the people in town. One thing led to another, and I met some, you know, some very gracious and helpful people that kind of took me under their wing. And they advised me to make this a nonprofit. And I love the idea because a nonprofit has a mission statement. Mine is enriching lives through music and live performance education. And I like the idea of being committed to a mission statement and doing something for the community more so than just hanging a shingle out on the door. So that's why I chose to go the route of a 501c3 nonprofit.
As a nonprofit, you can and do instruct both young and old on a whole band room full of instruments. Give us some examples, because on the website you can see people playing keyboards and drums and cello. And can they walk in with any instrument or any intention and you can find a way?
Yes, absolutely. Our instructors are all university trained that all have music degrees. Most of what we teach here is guitar, bass guitar, keyboards, mm-hmm. drums, piano, cello, violin. Those are the ones that we get the most call for. But we have voice lessons, you know, we have songwriting lessons. I have access to people on call, you know, that can cover brass and woodwind if there was a student that needed help with that.
On the phone with Mike Arturi, he is founder and executive director of the Universal Music Center. It's located in Red Wing, Minnesota, dubbed a learning center that rocks. A line I read on your website, Mike, said, make your musical dreams a reality. Let's talk about the relationship between the words dreams and reality. All the TV shows about becoming a star have served to convince people that literally anybody can do big things in the entertainment world. Tell me about the process you use when someone comes to you with dreams. Relay what your role is as counselor relative to dreams and reality.
Absolutely. First off, everything around here is positive, supportive of everyone's efforts. All of these instructors, these people are the real thing. We keep everything positive, but we are also very realistic with the students and with their parents. We never dissuade a dream, for sure, but we make sure that it's not a disappointment or a crushing thing when it may not happen. The odds of making a full-time living in 2020 are pretty slim playing a musical instrument, but there are many, many other income streams associated with the music industry that we like people to know about: songwriting, recording, publishing your own music. So there's a lot of different things about helping people understand what it's really like out there while being encouraging. If I could add, this is an important fact. We have 11 students right now that came to us as maybe 12 or 13-year-old young people and are now working professional musicians. One just signed a record deal this past weekend. Another one won an audition to perform on a cruise ship. He also did seasons at Valley Fair.
And a big part of your formula is performance, because after all, why learn all the good stuff if people are never going to hear you show what you can do? That's a cool thing that you do. And you put on, what, 4 concerts a year?
We do 4 official Universal Music Center live performances. It accelerates the learning process for anyone that's involved. Students that just came to us 8 years old and can play 1 chord on the guitar. And if they want to be in the show, they're in the show. But they come to a monthly rehearsal, and I talk to them about how to combat stage fright, how to be prepared to get up on stage, about how to present themselves. We give them a lot of professional advice about what it's really like to perform. And as they get older, you know, they start asking more and more pointed questions, and we guide them all the way.
Let's point out as well, Mike, that UMC welcomes people of all abilities, musical and physical.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. We're located on a ground level, no stairs, studios with an extra wide door, you know, for wheelchair access. Everybody is welcome here. We have sight impaired students. We've done a lot of work with children and people with autism, all sorts of challenges, but they're all welcome here and they all thrive.
I had the honor once of attending a powwow at the Lac-Couturier Reservation up in Hayward, Wisconsin, wherein, didn't participate, but witnessing was enough to blow me away, a drum circle. You participate in those. I think everyone, musician or not, should at one time in their life sit in on a drum circle, and I think it should be mandatory in Washington. How about we have a weekly drum circle where everyone participates, fits in, gets along? Good idea?
You know, that's a fantastic idea. Drum circles are a really interesting thing. When I first opened Universal Music Center, we were getting asked to bring students to all kinds of things, you know, maybe something for the Hope Coalition or something for the Chamber of Commerce, you know, or something for, you know, all these various groups. It's starting to get so much, you know, that I started feeling uncomfortable about asking these parents to bring these kids to all these different events. You know, I was waiting for someone to say to me, I'm paying you to teach my child music, not to use them as a promotional tool. You know, I thought, how can I still take advantage of these opportunities and not, you know, impede on these people's lives? So drum circles came to mind. I make my living as a drummer, playing drum set my whole life. I still practice. So the drum circles, even though they were drums, never really caught my attention. But then I started looking into it, and on one side of the coin, all you need to have is a willingness to participate. On the other side of the coin, there is verified data that could go around the moon and back 50 times about the benefits of these things and what they accomplish. So it's amazing. A great illustration is in a corporate setting. We could have the CEO sitting next to the guy that sweeps the loading docks. Neither one of them knows how to play a drum. All of a sudden, now they're just two guys having fun with this thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So that supports the statement you're saying about bringing it to Washington, which would be a great idea. I personally do a lot of work in the realm of social-emotional arts learning with the drum circles. All types of populations, you know, including seniors, including vulnerable adults, people with all levels of physical and mental challenges, at-risk youth. I work in juvenile correctional facilities with incarcerated youth. So I do a lot with the drum circles. And lately I've been doing a lot online. You know, I've actually been doing programs online for various end users. I'm a national artist for the John F. Kennedy Center Turnaround Arts Program, and I'm also a teaching artist for the Compass Arts Organization in St. Paul.
You start the movement, drum circles in Washington. I'll get involved, and we'll get involved. As you were talking, I went, duh, what do you think the D.C. stands for?
I'm in. Let's do it. It's you know, there.
That could be exactly what the gridlock needs. These guys sit together and have a little fun and go, you know, that guy across there, he's not so bad.
Yeah. You know, all of a sudden, these things play, right? And, you know, I show them a couple of little techniques on how to play the drums and stuff, but little by little, they just get it by themselves. And all of a sudden, you know, Frank is locking in with Joe. And, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we're playing together. You know, they're actually communicating on a whole different level. And it's a back and forth, you know, it's self-fueling. It's a great thing to see. And I think, let's do it. We're going to Washington.
Get to work on that. Let me know how it goes. I'll dive in when you need me.
Okay, great.
Well, success in the music business often boils down to being in the right place at the right time. And the Universal Music Center might just be the right place. Mike Artieri, thanks for being with us here on WPR and Spectrum West.
Thank you so much, Al. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And, of course, with the pandemic, the Music Center has done a lot of virtual stuff. People can take lessons online, and then they can drive into the school for rehearsals or to record in their multi-track recording studio. Doesn't matter where you live. I suggest you go to universalmusiccenter.com and get all you need to know. Hey, don't forget, Pablo Streams is a free virtual concert series, 6:30 p.m. throughout the summer. Lineups of two or more artists take the stage in the Jamf Theater and broadcast via the Paragon webcasting service to audiences. If you're listening on Thursday, the 16th, tonight, 6:30, it's Laska and Sniffle Party. Well, next week, who knows where I'll be, but it won't be here. However, we'll return on July 30th to resume our calling, which is bringing you the arts, music, and culture of West Wisconsin. Thanks to Dean, Jim, Catherine, Kate. Live safe, smart. Let's get together again in a couple weeks. Bye now.